Hello, I'm Alana Gordon. I'm a reporter at The World covering global health. Here at The World, we've been taking your questions to the experts in a regular series of coronavirus conversations. These conversations are in collaboration with The Studio at the Harvard Chan School. The whole series is featured on our Facebook page, but we wanted to share what we think are really valuable conversations with you right here in The World's podcast feed. This week, I spoke with William Hanage, an associate professor of epidemiology at Harvard's Chan School. We talked about Omicron and the latest on the pandemic.
Bill, thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Nice to be here.
Recently, the U.S. saw an average of more than 700,000 new cases of COVID-19 a day, and almost all of them were Omicron. It's a variant, it's hard to believe, that was first identified a mere 2 months ago. And in the U.S., cases are also finally on the decline in some parts of the country. Numbers still dwarf previous records, and obviously average 7-day death counts are nearly 2,000, so it's not nothing. I want to start with asking you what researchers like yourself have learned about this variant and what your big open questions still are about it.
Wow. Well, there are a number of things we have learned. The first thing I'm going to point out is that 700,000 is an undercount, because there's a lot of cases that have not been detected for all kinds of reasons, including limited testing capacity, the fact that some folks will have done a rapid antigen test, and then not sought the PCR, and then some folks will have just not sought testing at all. So that 700,000 is a lower bound. We have learned several things about Omicron. It is obviously a truly remarkable virus in terms of its capacity for rapid spread. And it looks like it is intrinsically more transmissible than Delta. What I mean there is that if you were to put a completely naive population with no immunity whatsoever, and you dropped Omicron in there and Delta in there, Omicron would spread quicker. It would spread to more people. It would also do so faster, because it looks like the generation time, the point between when people become infected and when they become infectious and capable of transmitting, is a little bit shorter for Omicron than it is for Delta. Obviously, as well, we also know that it is capable of evading prior immunity. And when I say that, I mean immunity which has been generated either by previous infection or by vaccines. It isn't able to fully evade it. I want to be very clear about this. Omicron is not a complete vaccine escape variant. It can sometimes feel like it is, but it isn't. It's actually, the vaccines protect extraordinarily well, especially if you are boosted, against severe infections. And it's almost certain that they do something to limit transmission as well. Otherwise, you may find it hard to believe, but Omicron's peaks would have been even higher than they have been. Finally, I want to get to this question of how severe the infections are. You're completely right. In this country right now, we're seeing 2,000 deaths average a day, which is, you know, let's put that into context. You know, a flu season, a bad flu season would be around 40,000 deaths over the entire year. That would be a pretty bad one. So we're seeing 2,000 deaths a day on average at the moment. So this is not any kind of trivial thing. It seems that the majority of the difference between the ratio of cases to deaths or hospitalizations in this wave versus previous ones is due to the fact that we have some immunity. Lots of people have immunity either through prior infection or through vaccination, and that's blunting it. I think that Omicron is a little bit less intrinsically dangerous than Delta, but not by that much.
What would it mean to have a prior infection versus vaccination versus nothing?
That's a great question. We have some data on this, which has come from people in the UK at Imperial College, and also from South Africa, who have been examining the causes and the outcomes of infections in people who have been both previously infected and not vaccinated, and so on and so forth. I want to point out that this is difficult work to do, because people may have been previously infected and not known about it. Is where it may not have been reported. Once you correct for that, it looks like being previously infected gives you, it reduces your risks of hospitalization by 40 to 50%. If you have been infected and vaccinated, that's dropped further. If you've been vaccinated and boosted, that goes down to the sort of 70, 80% reduction, which is, you know, a pretty serious thing. I want to be very clear, by the way, all of these things do depend a little bit on the time since vaccination, the time since infection, and so on and so forth, because immunity is not a fixed state. However, it's very clear that increased experience that our immune systems have handling the virus make it much less likely that we're going to be suffering severe outcomes. And that's really important.
Wow. We started off mentioning that cases have been quite high, but in some parts of the country and world, they've peaked or maybe plateaued, such as the UK. Do you anticipate that we're now on a kind of downslope, like what South Africa experienced, if we want to zoom out now, big picture?
Yeah, in some places, certainly. The one thing that I'm going to point out is that it's truly remarkable, in fact, how into a very, very sort of broad brush, how similar outbreaks are. They tend to peak about 35, 40 days after they get going, and that's true across South Africa's different provinces, different regions of the US. Small communities can be hit very hard and very quickly. That's important to note. But then things decline. Now, the crucial question is what's driving that decline? And there are roughly two things that could drive it. Firstly, there's immunity. And yeah, Omicron is generating immunity, no question of that. But there's also the changes in human behavior. This is all to do with the opportunities that we offer the virus to spread. And if you look at the data from last year, there was a peak around the 11th, 12th of January. If you look at the regular coronaviruses, the ones that we don't really think about as much as, you know, or at least we didn't think about so much, they have a peak around the second week of January. So this is consistent with the virus being introduced to a lot of host networks over the holidays. And then it goes through them. And after that, after it's exploited them fully, it then moves into the networks that we have seen, that, you know, the more standard spread, the more standard opportunities we give it. Incidentally, fun epidemiological fact, before vaccination against pneumococcus, the bacteria that causes pneumonia, there used to be peaks of pneumonia in older adults after the holidays, which was the result of them mixing with the kids who are a major source of that particular bacterium. Once the kids were vaccinated, the pneumonias in the adults dropped away at that time. So that's an example of indirect protection.
Go on. Well, I wanted to lead to another question, which is, you know, globally, and of course, these things depend on very specific dynamics within communities, but you're speaking about some things that there is a certain predictability, although one can't necessarily predict what new variant might come up potentially. But leaders of the WHO, the World Health Organization, have said that the, you know, the pandemic's far from over, but, you know, expressed hope this week that there might be an emergency phase ending this year, and that something like this coronavirus could become more manageable. Based on both the patterns of the past and what you're learning now about Omicron immunity, like, where do you see the world headed and what factors could impact that? Like, what does that mean to you?
In some ways, I could take statements that I made. I don't think it was to you, but it was in a setting very much like this about Delta. And just replace Delta with Omicron. By the late spring, almost everybody will have either been infected, vaccinated, or both. And what will then matter is the epidemiological characteristics of infections in those people, meaning how transmissible are they, and the clinical characteristics, meaning how likely are they to land a person in hospital or worse. And as I said, in, you know, repeated immunological experience with previous variants or previous or the vaccines indeed reduces our risks of severe outcomes. So I wouldn't necessarily make a prediction because I don't. Well, several things. Firstly, as you know, I never bet against natural selection. And I'm also not, I don't necessarily know exactly what characteristics of future variants might be. But my prior is that they're going to cause less severe disease among immunologically prepared people than they would if those people were not immunologically prepared. And so I think that it is reasonable to think that we are in a very different phase than we were even at this point last year.
Hmm. You know, you mentioned, and probably because I mentioned as well about can't predict new variants, but, you know, one thing that has come up recently is a subvariant of Omicron that scientists are investigating, BA.2. It's spreading in places like India and Denmark and the UK. What do you make of that subvariant?
Yeah, well, for a start, BA.2 is Omicron. It's, as you say, it is a subvariant. There is a very deep split in the Omicron family. And BA.2 branched off from the rest of Omicron, the BA.1s, around about this time last year. So it's very mysterious what it's been doing in the intervening time. It has a lot of the same characteristics as Omicron. Interestingly enough, it does not have the particularly distinctive test result that has been used to characterize Omicron so far. And what that means is that some of these early results, I'd be a little bit cautious of, because we do get biased testing. You could see it here because this result, which is called technically spike gene target failure, when people started seeing that coming up in their samples, they started prioritizing them for sequencing. Mm. And that meant that we thought that Omicron was spreading even quicker than it was. I mean, we were only out by a week or two, but I mean, you have to account for such biases. And given that we are looking now at data which is coming in only over the last few weeks, I think we need to wait a little while to really weigh in on that. Having said that, anything that is able to coexist with Omicron or with BA1 rather, any of these things is something worth taking very seriously indeed.
Hmm. I want to get to a lot of questions which are here, but I also want to address just as cases get so high, something that you've been looking into is how to assess policy responses, right? Cases are so high. And one of the things that you've called for is something called circuit breakers in terms of monitoring where hospitals are at. Has that gotten traction? How does that work?
Well, it's interesting. It hasn't gotten anywhere near as much traction as we'd like. And this is something I was involved with alongside Jeremy Faust, who's a colleague in the medical school, and Benji Renton, who both did phenomenal work putting together what is really a very, very simple approach, which takes the recently reported cases in a region, and then it looks at recent behavior in terms of how cases have been turning into hospitalizations and just projects out for a couple of weeks to basically say whether if you can continue at the current rate is going to be sustainable or not. Importantly, we do not just consider flat beds, you know, just the number of beds. We consider staffed beds because, an ICU bed without a skilled nurse is really just a bed with a machine going beep next to it. It's the personnel who are really important here. And what has been interesting is that that has been providing estimates or at least warning signs, localized warning signs, which have been ahead of the sort of official numbers. The reason why we did it is because data from Health and Human Services and the like takes a couple of weeks to come in. And so it's frequently too often telling people what happened already and what they knew about already. And it's an attempt to make those, advance those decisions. And I know from colleagues here and elsewhere that this is the kind of thing they've been needing and the kind of thing that has been very helpful. Mm-hmm. In many cases, the great majority, we have been correct in terms of saying this is going to be a problem coming up soon. What has been used to do, there have been very few policy changes made as a result of this. However, local healthcare systems have been able to do things like prepare by delaying elective procedures. By the way, that's not elective procedures sounds like it's something plastic surgery or something that people might typically not consider to be as essential. But it's a lot of very important things. It's a lot of important screening things that will pick up cases of cancer early on, for instance. It's not trivial to be canceling that. The fact that you need to do it is a sign of an outbreak which is out of control. I want to just, if I can, Alana, just moving on from that, point out there's a flip side to this, which is that just as you want to be able to be saying when you've got a really bad problem coming down the pike at you, you also want to be ready when it passes, because it does look like Omicron infections typically are less acute. People are not in hospital as long. And if this remains the case, then the hospitalization numbers may come down quite quickly. There's one very large caveat, and it's a very large caveat. The majority of infections so far have been in younger age groups. Now we have started to see infections in older age groups, and those are more likely to be suffering severe illness. And so that decline in the burden on healthcare may be much slower than the decline in cases.
I want to get to some direct viewer questions, maybe even just in kind of quick fire, because they're so great and specific. This comes from Mary Beth. Are people over 65 who've been vaccinated and boosted in danger of serious disease or hospitalization with Omicron?
If you have been vaccinated and boosted and you're over 65, the risk is not zero, but it's hugely decreased. Hugely decreased. I mean, the major concern that people in my position have on a population level is that too many people over the age of 65 have not been vaccinated and boosted. And they should be the highest priority for boosting. The risk is not nil, but it is greatly reduced. I think that there is some data. I didn't crunch these numbers myself, so I want to be absolutely clear about that. If you look at the risks of hospitalization in older people, it's roughly in vaccinated and boosted older people, it's roughly similar to the risks of hospitalization in unvaccinated younger people. In other words, really pretty low.
Wow.
So I think that if you are vaccinated and boosted, I would still suggest that when there's a lot of Omicron around, you take common sense steps. I mean, you know, wear one of these things when you're out and about, and you know, avoid those things, crowds, closed spaces, and close contact,
mm-hmm.
classic 3 C's, in particular when Omicron is peaking. But you should be much, much more confident about your ability to fend off severe infection.
Daniel asks, that also leads to this question, you know, the messaging and the data on boosters, but is, you know, we're starting to hear about some places offering like Israel second boosters. Is there a need for something like that?
I was actually discussing this with some friends of mine and friends and colleagues there last week. And there is a diversity of views. And I think that that's quite reasonable, because a fourth shot, a second booster, to an extent, it is kicking the can down the road. We've got a lot out of our immune systems already with 3 shots. A fourth booster is, I think, to be recommended for individuals who have not generated good immunity from the first 3, for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps older folks particularly if they are vulnerable for other reasons. And in Israel, it's also been offered to healthcare workers. Now, there is not a direct reason for that in terms of the risks of infection to healthcare workers, but there are multiple consequences of infecting a healthcare worker, including they can't go to work.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're having an Omicron surge, when you have a relatively large numbers of individuals who are having to isolate because they are sick, then giving them a shot which would make it much less likely they would be infected in the first place, even if it's only for a month or so, would be and could have advantages in preventing that.
I want to combine these two questions from Mary Beth and Kristen, and it might be a little bit outside your purview of what you research, but I want to ask it. Do you have any insight, this is from Mary Beth and Kristen, about trends and patterns when it comes to Omicron and long-term symptoms and conditions and long COVID? And is there any information on how that might compare with Delta, or how that might compare with somebody who has previous immunity from vaccination or previous infection?
These are very good questions. And you're right, I don't specifically research long COVID. But there are a few things there are a few comments that we can make about it, which are based on stuff which we've read or which have been seeing in the literature recently. The first thing is to note that acute viral illnesses are well known to produce long-term consequences in a minority of people.
Mm-hmm.
This is this, we've known this for a long time. The issue with the pandemic, of course, is that we have an enormous amount of acute viral illness. And so as a result of this, we have a large, much larger number of people who are experiencing this than usual. It's too early to be able to say anything specific about Omicron versus other variants. And indeed, it's very, very hard to study these things anyway. It's extremely important to not only to design your studies carefully, so you're comparing your Omicron or your Delta infections with other acute viral illnesses to see whether or not it is more likely than not. It's also important to account for immunity. And this is one of the good things. It seems to be the case that in at least some individuals, vaccination helps with the symptoms of long COVID or some of these long post-viral sequelae. And also, even though I do not know specifically the data for any study of long COVID among vaccinated and unvaccinated people, in particular in the context of Omicron. I mean, Alana, you said it was given a name around Thanksgiving. Okay, it hasn't simply been that long for these cases to be picked up. Even case series that I know of that we've been looking at, it's a real delay getting the data just because so many people have been infected is a huge workload following them up. So even though I don't know this and the data aren't in yet, I do want to say my prior, meaning my expectation, mm-hmm. would be that the risks of those symptoms will be reduced.
Okay. So
that's a positive thing.
I want to get to, oh my gosh, there's, okay, I'm just going to.
Omicron.
Omicron. So last month, the CDC changed its recommendations on isolation and quarantine. This is from Janice. People who test positive for COVID-19 only need to isolate for the U.S. for 5 days in the U.S. And those who are exposed to the virus but are unvaccinated or not up to date on vaccination only need to quarantine for 5 days. What do you see as the CDC getting right here? What would you do differently? And I also want to peg on something a little bit different, but in Europe for today, for example, some of the policy recommendations are changing around travelers, even whether they would need to, not from an exposure, but need to quarantine or test traveling now. So there's some changes that are different in that regard as well. Wanted to ask you about that.
Yeah, I mean, I want to point out that some of the issues that come about with these issues are just driven by Omicron's sheer transmissibility. I mean, this was part of the reason why. This is one of the things that was very central to what I was anticipating as early as the first week of December or a little before. Something with the transmission properties of Omicron creates problems on its own, regardless of how severe it is. Mm-hmm. It takes all your ICU nurses and makes them sick. Or, you know, if you're just working in a restaurant, suddenly half your staff are unwell and unable to come to work. I can't say enough. If everybody in the world got the common cold at the same time, there would be consequences. So with that, the CDC guidance is trying to, unfortunately, these are decisions which had to be made in the absence of a sound evidence base, just because of the fact that, as I said, there was not enough time to study Omicron and figure out how long people shed for. The decision that was made then, I think, is trying to balance the harms from the continued transmission that could occur. You know, I mean, I can't say again, it's very important to note, you cannot reduce risk to zero, or it's, mm-hmm. there's no way to reduce population risk to zero. You can reduce it though. And so this is an attempt to combine reducing that risk while also reducing the consequences, the indirect consequences of large Omicron outbreaks. We now know from studies of the NBA, among others, that a subset of people do continue to shed quantities of virus which are deemed to be infectious after that period. And that's one of the reasons why I would say, if you have been in that situation and you're about to go out and resume activities, take a rapid test. You know, they're going to be sent out for free now. Use a rapid test to determine when you are shedding small, you know, low enough quantities of virus, even if you were still officially positive on PCR, that you can continue to, that you should go out and be unlikely to contribute further to transmission. There is one other point that I will raise before moving on to Europe, which is that very realistically, if around here, the peak prevalence, meaning the numbers of individuals who are infected at the peak of the Omicron wave, was probably around 10%. You know, maybe a little less, maybe even a little more. Now, with that in mind, if I had to meet someone, if I was meeting somebody who tested positive 5 days ago, I would at least know they had tested positive. I would know to be doing it outside, wearing masks and so on and so forth. Whereas if I were to just go into a restaurant with a bunch of people who hadn't tested positive, there's a decent chance that one of them would have been currently shedding large quantities of virus. And so under those circumstances, it does actually make some sense to direct your infection control at the places where you know the virus is. Now, coming back to Europe and the issues that we're seeing here, travel is always a thorny subject. But if the prevalence in the place you're going to is roughly the same as the prevalence in the place you're coming from, then doing very much to try and prevent things in terms of quarantine and so on isn't really an efficient use of resources. And given that Omicron is everywhere, it isn't really an efficient use of resources right now. And so it actually makes considerable sense.
Well, this question's from Renee, going back to what you said about, you know, you recommend taking a test if you test positive after. There's the federal government in the US is issuing free tests to households. And at the same time, many are hearing about antigen test kits that may have some lag time, serious lag time with detecting Omicron. What are you learning about rapid testing and as a screening tool, as a ability to be useful in informing one whether they are infectious?
When you say lag time, what do you mean exactly? You mean the idea that...
So I would think that this listener is asking, you know, whether you may be sick with Omicron, but it's not coming up on the test.
So that this is a really, again, this is an area of emerging evidence. There is certainly some evidence from cohorts of individuals who work in nursing homes and similar facilities who are very frequently tested to suggest that people can be PCR positive, meaning detectable RNA, and with quite large amounts of viral RNA, but negative on antigen tests. It's difficult to ascertain whether or not that's something to do with the way the test was being taken. And it's also difficult to ascertain whether or not it's to do with whether or not you're swabbing the anterior nares or the back of the throat. There's some evidence that suggests that the back of the throat may turn up more rapidly early on. Now, implementing this into an actual policy is hard. For a start, you don't have the evidence base to compare the nares and the throat. Secondly, people may not want to take a test if it involves swabbing the throat because it's less comfortable. You know, personally, I've done both when I've taken a test recently. But you know, the situation is that if you are shedding, it's a particularly relevant thing to if you know you have been infected or PCR positive. If at that point you know that you have been shedding virus, if at some point in the future you take a rapid test and it's negative, that's a much better signal that you can be confident that you have recovered and you're no longer shedding. Now, that's a separate question from screening. In screening, which is the idea is to pick up people who are infectious but don't necessarily know it yet, I think that it's probably important to consider what circumstance you're using your test for. You know, what's the most important? Are you going to be going to see your elderly relative, or are you using it in order to before a kid's play date? Because we don't necessarily have as many tests as we would like. And this leads to, you know, this leads to difficulties there. I would personally suggest take your test and make sure you use it wisely. And the wisest places to use it are when you're avoiding introducing the virus to high consequence networks, or if to be sure that you are yourself recovered and not shedding virus.
Okay. Well, I hope it's okay to ask a few more questions. Schools. This is a question from Maggie. Schools have been a flashpoint of debate over COVID restrictions.
Oh, haven't they?
I mean, have you heard?
Yeah. School.
Is it safe for kids to be in schools during a big surge like this one?
And the first thing I want to say is safe is a word that people often It's a word that's very difficult within this context, because do you mean safe for the students? Do you mean safe for the community as a whole? Do you mean, and so on and so forth? Remember, we cannot reduce risk to zero, otherwise we'd never drive the kids to school. So, I mean, the question is how you can reduce it. But anyway, I interrupted. Carry on.
How should families and districts and communities be thinking about COVID surges? Like, is it a good idea for kids to go to school during the surge? Should districts establish certain thresholds when it should go to online learning? What are you learning, for example, in Cambridge, and how does that apply elsewhere?
Well, that's a very important point. You know, I live in Cambridge, Massachusetts, which is a pretty well-resourced school district. And so what I talk about in that context is learning from that particular school district. It may be much more difficult to apply in less well-resourced school districts. Incidentally, that's an argument for school districts being well-resourced. So with that in mind, I think that I've been on record for a long time as saying that schools should be the first thing to open and the last thing to close. The thing that you also want to deal with, and it's very important to distinguish when you think about thresholds, is that it's not so much what's happening out there in the community, it's whether or not there's transmission happening within the schools. Because if there's not transmission happening within the schools and kids are really only entering the school setting, having been infected outside but not transmitting, there isn't really any contribution to the epidemiology from the schools. Mm-hmm. The other thing we need to do is be very clear to distinguish between the under 10s and the over 10s. Even in South Africa's data, you can see that the dynamics in the under 10s are very different from the over 10s in the adolescents. And that's always been the case. It's thought to be because younger kids have less amounts of the receptor that the virus uses to enter cells. So that was true for Omicron as well as for previous waves. So that's a key question of whether or not there's transmission in the schools. Now, some of you may know this, but Cambridge inadvertently conducted an experiment, because they did PCR testing on 3,500 or more students and staff before opening the schools. They set aside 2 days to do this. And the plan was that they were going to put them into pools of 10, and then whichever pools came back positive, they would test individual samples from those. Sounds like a good plan, but under such circumstances, the higher the expected prevalence, the higher the proportion of tests you expect to come back positive, the smaller the pool needs to be. And as it was, 43% of the pools came back positive.
When was this? After the holidays?
This was the 3rd of January. Okay. So on the 3rd of January, I stood indoors in a line with my daughter for well over an hour with a bunch of other people being tested. Given the fact that more than one test in a pool could be positive, around 6% of the people being tested were positive. There were no large outbreaks associated with this. And indeed, since then, while there have been a lot more cases in schools in Cambridge, there haven't been very large outbreaks. I mean, there have been cases, yes. There has probably been some transmission. There has not been large amounts of transmission. And that's over the period of the most Omicron locally. And as you know, we are now starting to subside again. And I think that this is the kind of thing which should give people confidence that schools can be open without necessarily contributing to large surges. I do want to make a very, very clear point, though. There are lots of people in this country with lots of very different experiences, and individuals who are perhaps living in multi-generational households or with people who are at risk, it's a very, very difficult and challenging situation to be in for them. And I fully understand that. The goal should be to ensure that there is not a higher risk of transmission or acquisition in schools than other places. We know that this is a virus which transmits in clusters and in particular in large gatherings, and schools are a large gathering we do not want to have to stop.
Okay. I want to ask you about you gave a few anecdotes about your own life and being in this line, but I often wonder from epidemiologists like yourself, researchers, like with Omicron, how has that, or in what way has that changed the way you understand and assess your own risks and behavior? And it's a confusing time, or there's a changing time. And I wanted to ask you that.
It's a good question. And obviously, I can only speak for myself. I find it quite useful to contrast it with Delta, mm-hmm. because just before Thanksgiving, in fact, the week of Thanksgiving, I was having these wonderful, I remember waking up every morning feeling well rested and having had wonderful dreams, because I was quite confident that a very well boosted population with large numbers of children vaccinated was likely to have a winter that would be comparatively quiet. And of course, by the end of the week, that had all been torn up and tossed in the trash. But personally, with Omicron, my attitude is, as much as anything, that you can tell from my accent that I'm not from around these parts originally. As much as anything, my desire to not get Omicron is because if I need to travel at short notice or something like that, because that would be very, very seriously disruptive. Similarly, I would not want to be infected with Omicron, transmit to my children take it into the school and any transmission occur from there. So these are the issues that I'm dealing with. As a comparatively healthy, youngish sort of person who is vaccinated and boosted, I do not feel at strong personal risk of severe outcomes from the virus. And indeed, many of my friends have actually been intimately acquainted with the virus. So as much as anything else, my own attitude to risk is to avoid cases where I can be infected, because I don't want to contribute to dangers in my community. And I do not personally want the disruption of being unable to do things that I want to do.
How does that affect navigating social gatherings, public spaces?
For instance, and it's an important context, you know, as we've said, all of this is context dependent. You need to think about where you are. I know that cases in Cambridge are comparatively low at the moment. So mm-hmm. I would still personally not go to a large unmasked gathering, you know. There will be a point when I will happily go to watch my football club, soccer club, at the local sports bar and, you know, have a beer. But it's not going to be for a while yet. Instead, I'm keeping the contacts to those which are particularly important. So, for instance, that includes kids going to school. That includes coming to work and having personal one-on-one interactions with the small group of people who I work with closely. It does not mean that I'm going to be going to large gatherings.
Thank you for sharing that. I wanted to just wrap up and ask some bigger picture questions that we started out with, which is, you know, as Omicron surges and maybe on the decline in some parts of the US, are we just expecting it to infect everybody? And is this the case around the world? And what does that mean if there's some level of Omicron brings some level of immunity around the world?
The question of whether or not we expect it to infect everyone, I want to point out that given the basic parameters of Omicron that we've estimated, Omicron ought to have infected way more people than it has. The fact it hasn't says something about the contacts that we're allowing it to spread among and the state of immunity within the population as it is. Neither of those things are going to remain constant. So it's going to carry on. Also, don't count Delta out. Delta is not as obviously immune evasive as Omicron, but it does have the ability to sort of outpace the immune system by replicating very quickly before the initial B cell response gets kicked off. And so Delta is currently very rare. Delta was very rare in South Africa. Don't mistake the fact that Omicron grew quickly in that context as meaning that Delta is necessarily going to go extinct. But the point is, you know, the wider point is very large numbers of people are going to be infected with Omicron. At some point, you know, almost everybody is going to be having some encounter with the virus. And the immunity that will result from that is going to mean that the next time they see the virus, they're less likely to be ill, severely ill. And so that is an important factor. Now, I would point out that if the way to get that immunity is not to get infected, the ideal way to get that immunity is to be vaccinated, because you're then acquiring the immunity without the risks of infection and without something that you can transmit to other vulnerable folks. So get vaccinated. I'm sure most of the people listening to this are vaccinated, if not boosted. if you are actually in one of those communities which are under vaccinated or not boosted, and you are in a position of authority and trusted, please speak to your fellow citizens. Please try and encourage them to be vaccinated and boosted, because that's going to do a huge amount to prevent the worst consequences of Omicron, and indeed whatever comes after Omicron.
I just want to ask, see if there's any more things that you would like to wrap up with or conclude with. And with that, are you feeling hopeful about the pandemic entering a different kind of phase in the coming months?
I'm sure it's going to enter a different phase. And I think that hopeful is probably the wrong word. What I'm fond of pointing out is that optimism can be a relative term. I am very aware and very thankful that the amount of immunity that we have around us is such that the worst consequences of Omicron will not be realized. Those consequences that are being realized, as we've said a couple of times, are an average of 2,000 deaths a day, probably quite possibly ticking up a bit more beyond that. So let's not break out the ticker tape parade just yet. Having said that, over the summer, we expect things to be quieter, because things tend to be quieter in the summer. Although I'd say, once again, watch the South, watch Florida, watch Texas, watch those places which have given us warnings in the past. And just remember, a pandemic is a marathon, not a sprint. I do think that we're closer to the finish line now than we were. But before anybody runs away from this full of confidence and, you know, looking forward to the sunlit uplands which lie the other side of the Omicron peak, I want to bear in mind, Omicron leapt into our lives a few months ago and transformed what we were expecting. So just don't count your chickens before they're hatched.
That was William Hanage, a professor of epidemiology at the Harvard Chan School. This Q&A was jointly presented by the studio at Harvard's Chan School and us here at The World. You can view the video of this conversation at our Facebook page. You can find that at theworld.org/Facebook, and see more from the series at theworld.org/coronavirus-conversations. Thanks for listening.